Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. This is episode 25, entitled Nero Off the Leash. And that's actually quite appropriate because at the time of recording, a neighbour of mine's dog is howling away because the poor thing's been left home alone. And I'm probably not going to be able to edit it out of the background, but at least it'll add a little bit of atmosphere for us, I think. So, it's AD 59, and Rome is reeling in the aftermath of the murder of the formidable Agrippina. Seneca's ghost letter, written for Nero about Agrippina's depravities and political plotting, has been presented to the Senate, and it's been met with mixed reactions. Most senators, whether they believed what was being presented to them about Agrippina's failed attempt on Nero's life or not, were playing it safe, and they joined in the circus of thanksgiving orchestrated by Seneca for the emperor's salvation. A very few, though, like Thrasea Paetus, who'd left the Senate house in disgust while the charges against Agrippina were being read, were having none of it. Paetus was fully aware that his refusal to join in with the other sycophants in voting Nero honours for his glorious escape from Agrippina's supposed assassination attempt was going to put him in danger. But he simply didn't care. "Nero can kill me," he's reported to have said, "but he can't harm me." And as for the people of Rome, well, they were now well used to the farce into which their imperial house had descended. But that wasn't to say that they approved of what was going on. The ancient commentators report a sense of unease, a sense of feeling that this time Nero really had gone too far, and that his downfall was only a matter of time. On the surface, the citizens allowed themselves to be seen rejoicing that the emperor had survived the dreadful ordeal as painted by Seneca, while in private they slagged him off as they waited for the hammer to fall. Here and there, though, public derision did break out, albeit in an anonymous fashion, because no one yet had the guts to openly ridicule the emperor. In preparation for Nero's triumphal entry back into Rome, somebody, probably Seneca, had organised for all statues of Agrippina to be pulled down. But time restraints had left one standing, over which a covering had to be thrown, something which gave it the appearance of being veiled. Now, knowing that Nero would pass this way and see it, some wag affixed an inscription which read, "I am abashed and you are ashamed." Elsewhere, graffiti had been scrawled, enlisting the emperor into the ranks of other well-known mother killers. A common one was Orestes, Nero, Alcmeon, matricides all. And, under cover of night, a leather sack was draped over one of Nero's statues, the implication being that Nero should be subjected to that terrible punishment reserved for all parricides, which was to be sewn into a leather bag along with a dog, a cockerel, a viper and an ape, and then thrown into the river Tiber to drown. But perhaps the saddest protest of all was when a baby was hurled into the forum with a tag affixed to it, along with the message, "I will not raise you in case you kill your mother." So yes, there were mutterings and some disquiet, but Seneca had engineered it so that Nero could return to Rome in triumph, a godling whose salvation from assassination surely showed his high favour in the eyes of the divine gods. But Seneca had allowed Nero to get away with murder. This was the second time. The first had been when Nero had, in all likelihood, arranged for his stepbrother Britannicus to be poisoned in AD 55. Seneca had gone into massive damage control mode back then as well, publishing his De Clementia in an attempt to convince the Roman people that Nero, as the true heir of the great Augustus, was destined for great things. But the problem with allowing somebody to get away with murder, of course, is that they begin to feel they are untouchable. And by AD 59, Seneca must have been wondering what the hell kind of monster he had allowed to be created. According to some of the ancient commentators, Nero was also guilty, shortly after murdering his own mother in AD 59, of knocking off his paternal aunt Domitia, this time because he was covetous of her wealth and estates, especially the ones near the resort town of Baiae. The rumour mill went into overdrive, and a story went around that during a visit to the venerable old dear, who would have been in her mid to late 60s and was confined to her bed because of severe constipation, Nero ordered the doctors to administer a fatal dose of laxative. If the story has any validity, it would have been a cruel and painful way to send somebody to meet their maker. And the situation was made even worse by the suggestion that Nero seized all of Domitia's property as she lay dying. So brazen was Nero becoming that he started openly accusing young senatorial class men whom he saw as politically dangerous to himself of treason, and then having them stoned to death by his soldiers. The situation was becoming so bad that Seneca tried to caution Nero against killing off too many potential rivals. "No matter how many you slay," he told the emperor, "you won't be able to kill your successor." But by AD 59, Seneca, along with his political ally, the Praetorian commander Burrus, had long given up on moulding Nero into some kind of philosopher king. The young man, he was still only 21 in the second half of AD 59, was a loose cannon. He'd always been a fan of the four-horse chariot races that drew huge crowds in ancient Rome, but because the sport was considered an indulgence of the plebs, he'd not been allowed to indulge his passion. Now, though, Seneca and Burrus caved in, and they set up a racing track for Nero's private use in what is nowadays the Vatican Valley. They'd hoped that allowing Nero to race his teams outside the city proper would keep his obsession away from prying eyes, but it didn't take long for Nero to admit what he imagines to be an adoring public to watch him practice. Ever the showman, he would sprinkle the arena with gold solder when he was about to give an exhibition of chariot racing and charge around in a flowing golden cloak. Nero's other great passion was the stage. He fancied himself a brilliant player of the musical instrument, the lyre, and he'd perform in public despite having, so say the reports, only a slight and indistinct voice. Nero, though, obviously didn't consider himself as having rubbish vocal projection, as he set aside certain days per month on which, in order to protect his voice, he'd only eat chives that had been soaked in oil. He was accustomed to dress in the garb of a lyre player and perform to an audience that was seeded with elements ordered to rave about the deluded emperor's musical talents. The common people didn't know whether to laugh or cry at the ridiculous spectacle unfolding before their eyes, but the sight of Seneca and Burrus standing beside the emperor, madly gesturing to the audience to follow their lead and wave their arms and togas after everything that came out of Nero's mouth, must have made them err on the side of caution and pretend to be amazed at their emperor's musical prowess. But Nero hadn't just left it to Seneca and Burrus to ensure he'd be rapturously received. He organised a specially trained troop of 5,000 soldiers that he called the Augustiani. Some commentators say this group was composed of powerful young Roman knights, and this lot were ordered to lead enthusiastic applause while at the same time showering Nero with praise, and the idea was to intimidate everyone else present to follow suit. Even the senatorial class joined in the sycophantic adulation of what must have been a truly bizarre spectacle, lauding Nero as Apollo, the god of music, and calling him Our Augustus and another Pythian in reference to the oracle at Apollo's temple at Delphi. One senator, though, was having none of it. Good old Thrasypius. He was staying true to his disdain for the farce into which Nero's principate was swiftly descending, and he didn't bother even turning up. Now, we've talked in earlier podcasts about having to remember that at this stage in his principate, Nero's spiteful malevolence was directed mainly at the upper echelons of Roman society, that's the senatorial and, to a lesser extent, equestrian classes. To the bulk of the Roman plebs, their emperor would have been a source of high entertainment. He laid on spectacular games and marvellous exhibitions, and so long as he wasn't directly messing with their own lives by doing something radical like interrupting the grain supply, as some of his predecessors, notably Caligula, had done, the plebs would have been, for the most part, amused onlookers on a power game which, although deadly to its participants, didn't to any real extent impact on the people themselves. When it came to messing with the upper classes, though, Nero was beginning to scale whole new heights. He corralled them into joining in and performing in his public entertainments, delighting in the social embarrassment he was causing them. He would get senators and knights, along with their wives and families, to participate in shows at the theatre, at the circus, and even the hunting arena, which was normally reserved for low-life criminals. Members of some of Rome's most ancient and noble families were made to play the flute, sing either as part of the chorus or to accompany the lyre, dance in pantomimes or act in tragedies and comedies. Others were made to take part in the events at the arena, driving horses, killing wild beasts, or fighting as gladiators. Although some of the great family's younger bucks embraced the danger and excitement, the majority did not. Fearing such public humiliation, patrician Romans flocked to schools where they could learn the arts of the stage and become at least proficient in singing and dancing, and they did this in an attempt to avert at least some of the mocking laughter. Some of them wore masks so as not to be recognised, but Nero was not going to let them get away with that, and he had the masks ripped off in full view on the excuse that it had been demanded by the crowd. It's no wonder that Pliny the Elder, a contemporary of these events, summed up what most of the upper echelon of Roman society must have been feeling about Nero, albeit the Elder Pliny only wrote this once Nero was safely dead. And he called the emperor the feces generis humana, the dregs of the human race. There were no complaints about any of this from the common people, though. They didn't mind. Not only were they being right royally entertained, but Nero, ever the showman, would have tokens hurled into the crowd in the form of little balls with a prize inscribed on them, horses, gold, silver, even slaves, which could be redeemed when presented. So, back to Seneca. And was this what the, at least in his own mind, one-time great philosophical idealist had come to? Despite all his high-flown rhetoric, his prolific intellectual literary musings and philosophical theorising, all Seneca seemed to have become was a cheerleader, a pretend fanboy to a 21-year-old narcissistic megalomaniac over whom he'd lost all control, and of whom he was, in all likelihood, absolutely terrified. The problem was that at this point in his career, Seneca was caught between a rock and a hard place. As the amicus principis, the emperor's closest advisor, Seneca was, in effect, behind a political firewall. That he had enemies within the senatorial ranks goes without saying. We've already had a look at his brilliant exculpatory masterpiece, De Vita Beata, in which he managed to throw charges of hypocrisy and adultery back on his accusers, for whom the bent old attorney, Publius Soilius Rufus, had probably been the mouthpiece. Seneca's closeness to Nero had helped him back then. Nero had even intervened in the trial personally to annul some of Soilius's accusations about illicit legal carryings on during the reign of Claudius. So Seneca was well aware that, for the time being anyway, he would have to stand or fall with the emperor. Burrus, the praetorian commander, too, was caught in the trap. The proud old soldier was reduced to standing beside his emperor on stage, embarrassed by how things had come to pass, but having to applaud nevertheless. Seneca could see the way things were going. He had, after all, lived through the reigns of Caligula and Claudius, and now, in all likelihood, in his early, possibly even mid-60s, it had, in my opinion, finally dawned on him that, if things continued the way they were going, history was going to witness yet another blood-soaked debacle of a Julio-Claudian principate. And this time, the finger of accusation was going to point squarely at the tutor come advisor who had not had the balls or the smarts to mould his charge into a decent ruler. Future generations, realised Lucius Annaeus Seneca, would hold him as the primary culprit, personally responsible for screwing it all up. But Seneca still had his stylus and his wordsmithery, and although he'd given up on turning Nero into even a halfway acceptable ruler, he still possessed the means to attempt to extricate himself from the whole rapidly disintegrating mess and exculpate himself in the eyes of future historians. And there's even a possibility, which I'll deal with in greater detail in a later podcast, that at this point in time, that's late AD 59, early AD 60, Seneca may have begun to seriously consider the option of toppling Nero and taking over the reins of power himself. But more of that later. For the time being, we have to take a look at another of Seneca's works, which I would contest that he composed at exactly around this time in his career and life. It's called De Beneficiis, which, for argument's sake, will translate for now as On Benefactions. De Beneficiis has a postulated compositional window of between 56 to 64 AD, but it could, in all fairness, have been written even before that time slot. However, for me, it contains pointers that positively reek of the period around AD 59 to 60, when Seneca, having lost all control of Nero, was about to go into self-preservation mode. The work itself is long, 7 books or sections, thus making it by far the most comprehensive of Seneca's surviving so-called dialogi or dialogues. Beneficia, or benefactions, the subject matter Seneca was addressing in the work, were part of the massively subtle and complex Roman system of what was, in essence, patronage and favour exchange. In its simplest form, it was a process of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, you do me a favour now and I'll return it at some stage when you need my assistance. And what changed hands could be anything. It could be money, goods, slaves, political support, a recommendation for official office, an introduction to somebody to whom you'd normally have no access. It could be anything. But this deceptively simple reciprocal process was in reality highly involved, and it was fraught with subtleties. Look, we don't have time to go into the history and intricacies of the system in this podcast. If the topic floats your boat, you can read Seneca's De Beneficiis for yourselves. But it should be obvious that the higher your standing, the higher your social standing, so and the more your power, wealth, and influence, the more beneficia you could bestow and therefore have owed back to you. In a way, it was a power game. It was a case of sifting through your built-up beneficia bank when it became necessary to see what accrued favours could be called in to give you an edge in your current situation. So why do I think it would have suited Seneca's situation at the end of AD 59 to write De Beneficiis? Well, first of all, Seneca was rattled. He had enemies in the Senate, and the factor that had prevented him from being too badly politically mauled by adverse criticism, i.e. Nero, was now behaving far too erratically to be relied on to continue providing that protection in future. Seneca could feel things beginning to unravel and fall apart. It was time for him to start reminding people that they owed him favours. De Beneficiis is all about establishing Seneca as the ultimate authority on a system that he believes holds together the whole fabric of contemporary Roman society. De Beneficiis is a very Roman book. Yes, the concept of patronage and what the Greeks called charis had a pedigree in the Stoic philosophical school, but it's Seneca himself, or so he strongly implies, whose work De Beneficiis is the last word on the subject. Seneca knows how to play this game, that's the message he's broadcasting, so let there be no cases of selective memory when it comes to repaying the help that he once gave others. Seneca also devotes a sizable portion of De Beneficiis to criticising the prevailing corrupted and perverted state of Epicurean doctrine in his contemporary Rome. Now, this is something he accused his political detractors of doing in the brilliant De Vita Beata, and it's also a clever philosophical smokescreen behind which he can covertly criticise Nero's worsening debauchery excess without mentioning the emperor's name. And probably a bit closer to the bone as far as criticism of Nero is concerned is when towards the end of book 4 of De Beneficiis, Seneca goes on an absolute rant about the bloodthirsty excesses of Gaius, that's the emperor Caligula. Now, it's true that Seneca doesn't spare his disdain for Caligula and several others of his works, but here in De Beneficiis, he describes Gaius as Caesar Orbi Terrarum, or the ruler of the world, and that's an epithet that Nero was fond of applying to himself. But it's book 7 of De Beneficiis that really makes me think it fits in with what was going on around Seneca in late AD 59 and early AD 60. I've mentioned many times previously during this podcast that it's often the citational pattern evidence, that's the way in which Seneca cites other authors, that can provide signposts and works that are otherwise devoid of chronological markers. When Seneca drops his philosophical forebears and starts to cite recent or contemporary Roman sources, especially non-philosophical Roman sources, you can bet your bottom dollar that he's about to get political. And that's exactly what happens in De Beneficiis, Book 7. For me, the most remarkable passages in Book 7 are those that reference the Cynic philosopher Demetrius, and we know that he was active in Rome around this time. The Cynics, who are sometimes called Stoics without shirts, shared many tenets with the Stoic school, especially where it concerned perfecting reason to achieve equanimity of mind and exile emotion. The Cynics decried materialism and advocated a life in harmony with the modest dictates of nature, but they differed from the Stoics in one major respect. Whereas the Stoics saw the political engine of state as a manifestation of the natural law of things, which as such should be guided along the path of moderation and practiced to the benefit of all, the Cynics wanted none of it. To them, political ambition was a waste of energy that could be better spent on self-improvement. Okay, I'm going to devote a lot more time as part of an upcoming podcast to the Seneca-Demetrius dynamic. But for now, we need to take note of two things. The first is that Seneca, in De Beneficiis, introduces and talks about Demetrius in extremely flattering and positive terms. It's as if Seneca, realizing the tattered mess his own reputation is in because of his proximity to and close relationship with the increasingly dissolute Nero, genuinely admires and even envies Demetrius, who's free to practice his philosophy the way he chooses. The second thing to note is that cynicism, as a philosophical school, was politically inert. No ambition meant no political aspirations, so it was not the type of school to excite the envy or enmity of factions within the Senate or at the Imperial Palace. Cynicism was, to all intents and purposes, a safe philosophy. We're going to see in upcoming podcasts how important that state of not being seen as an active philosophical interferer in public affairs would become, especially as Nero's behaviour went further and further off the rails. For now, though, Seneca, it would seem, was testing the waters. It was worthwhile to publish in De Beneficiis that he was mates with, indeed actively admired the behaviour of, a man who was well known on the streets of contemporary Rome and considered politically harmless, and see what reaction he got. Seneca even went as far as to relate an anecdote about a verbal confrontation between Demetrius and the Emperor Caligula, in which Demetrius came off best. Now, Seneca was definitely up to something by suddenly introducing the hitherto unreferenced Demetrius to his prose corpus, and we're going to find out what it was as we work our way through the remaining years of Seneca's life. So in AD 59, early AD 60, some of Seneca's chickens were coming home to roost. Due to a persistent and ongoing medical condition, he'd not seen active military service and had no martial pedigree to speak of or fall back on. But he compensated for that by fighting his battles with words, often elevating his writings, even the philosophical ones, into an almost literarily martial style, which was his way of combating the public perception of his lack of virtus or manliness. You'll find plenty of martial language and terminology in Seneca's works, and De Beneficiis is no exception. It was getting to the stage, though, where, in his dealings with Nero, literary brilliance was no longer going to be enough. It's been said that Seneca, in his writings, was a mask wearer, swiftly changing what and how he wrote to suit his changing agenda. But there are only so many masks, and you can only get away with wearing them for so long. In the next podcast, we'll look at the extremely interesting year of AD 60, during which Nero was terrified by news of a full-scale revolt in the fledgling province of Britannia, and we'll investigate what, if anything, our Lucius Annaeus Seneca had to do with it. So I hope to see you there.